Today's podcast is brought to you by, for the first time,
two
sponsors.
Hey.
We are literally growing by dozens of dollars a day.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
This is fantastic. And we should preface these sponsorship bits by saying that we only accept sponsors on the podcast if they have a product that we really support, believe in, and or use if possible.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we can't use the first sponsor's product, Health IQ, because they are US life insurance and we are Canadians.
But it's still amazing because it's something that you used to rant and rave about all the time when you were an investment advisor, the fact that healthy people paid more for life insurance than unhealthy people, but no more.
Yes. Health IQ has set up their company in such a way that triathletes, swimmers, cyclists, runners, vegans, people who take care of themselves can get as much as a 25% savings on their life insurance, which really just makes sense. That's the way that it should be. That was one of the ranty and ravey things because guys like me, I had to pay just as much as
the burger and fries, never getting off the couch guy.
Yes. Yes. Not ideal. If you want to learn more about Health IQ, go to healthiq.com/triathlon Taryn. They've bundled up all of the triathlete specific information there. Or if you end up calling in or just going to the website on your own, use the code triathlon Taryn. It's not going to save you any money because Health IQ is already
saving you the money.
Ideally saving you money. But let's Health IQ know that you came from us and helps support the show.
And our other sponsor, welcome to the show, Four Sigmatic and their mushroom coffees / drinks.
That's right. This is one that I actually use. I started using Four Sigmatic in early 2017 because I was finding that just the 3 cups of coffee that I have a day was enough to kind of get me addicted. Like I was feeling like I craved it, even though I didn't really want it.
And it didn't taste good.
And by the end of it, like you get that acid feeling and an energy crash at the end of the day. Not with Four Sigmatic. They only have 50 milligrams of caffeine, which is about a quarter to a half as much as a typical cup of coffee. And because it's mushroom based, you don't have that energy crash. You don't have the stomach rot. It's tasty stuff.
Well, and this applies too to non-coffee drinkers because these drinks have benefits that a lot of people can use or would be beneficial to them because they're benefits. So they're made out of mushrooms, all kinds of different mushrooms, cordyceps, lion's mane, chaga, and all of these mushrooms are being found. There's tons of research going into it that they're huge for things like, you know, immune function.
The chaga elixir is not necessarily a coffee, more of an immune booster.
Right. And then there's lion's mane, which supports memory and concentration. You had that this morning. You are clearly on the ball now.
I am firing on all cylinders right now.
So really cool stuff. Tastes really good. You love the taste of it. You drink this stuff all the time now. And again, tons of benefits for coffee drinkers and non-coffee drinkers alike.
Yep. And we've worked out a deal with Four Sigmatic that if you go to foursigmatic.com/triathlon Taryn or use the coupon code triathlon Taryn, you can save 15% on any order. Not a first order, not a second order, not like limited time only, all the time. Disclosure, that is an affiliate link. So it does help us out if you use that, but help me help you.
Yes, it's good. Go buy it. Yes. Now on to the show.
Today's podcast guest is Laura Siddle, who has had a fantastic 2017 last year, but a lot of people probably don't know it because she spent most of her time on the challenge circuit. She's been a pro for, what was it, NTK? 4 years, 5 years, no?
Something like that.
4 years, 5 years, yeah. And last year, she raced primarily in the challenge series in Europe, actually finishing second in the overall standings, just in behind Yvonne Van Vlerken, but ahead of awesome athletes, Sophie Goose, Heather Wortel, Lucy Charles, all in behind Laura. And we chatted with her about things like having the guts to leave her job because she didn't come up through the development ranks of Ironman as a lot of people do. She had to leave a corporate career in mechanical engineering.
As an adult and in her late 20s at that.
Yeah, like well into life.
So folks, if you're listening, this might be your chance to understand how you could become a pro if you've just taken up the sport.
Chat about things like the moment in Ironman New Zealand where she passed Meredith Kessler and what goes on in a pro's mind when they're kind of
passing a friend who's having trouble,
but also caught with sort of the realities of having to make a living as a pro and move up the ranks on the podium. We also talk about the implications of not racing Ironman primarily and focusing on challenge.
And
Kona.
Kona.
Talk about Kona. Obviously, we can't go through a Triathlon Terran podcast without talking about Kona.
We're kind of obsessed with Kona.
Everyone is.
That's true. And you know what? I just like the cut of her jib. She's
nice,
a pretty cool lady.
Nice gal. Yeah. And she talks about using her superpowers for good and not evil and why that is.
And we talk about a dog.
And a dog.
Pretty much. It's the best podcast ever.
Very good podcast. Dogs, chocolate, superpowers, invisible cloaks, good things. Enjoy. All right. Well, let's get rolling here. We are on the podcast with Laura Siddle. Thanks for being here, Laura.
Thanks very much for inviting me. It's good to chat to you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Where are you located right now? I know you're like a total globetrotter and actually make a point of going all around the world.
Yeah, I'm down in Christchurch in New Zealand, so down in the Southern Hemisphere. And I base myself here from kind of November through to May, over their summer periods, and train down here and race in Australia and New Zealand. And then when it starts to get too cold for me, I migrate to the Northern Hemisphere and go and race in Europe over their summer.
Why specifically New Zealand? You don't hear that as a hotbed that a ton of people go and set up shop for.
No, which is why it's fantastic. it's not too overcrowded. There's quite a few sheep around, but my coach, Matt Dixon, who's based in the States, he works, I guess he's sort of 2IC right-hand man or coaching partner, is a guy called Paul Buick, who's a New Zealander, a Kiwi, and he lives in Christchurch. So I came here for the first time about 3 years ago, I think, to spend a couple of months working specifically with Paul and cycling, and just loved it so much and just really enjoyed Christchurch as a place. The training's really convenient and easy, and when I say easy, I mean it's just, you know, it's riding from your door and you've got hills or flats and running from the door, and there's swimming pools, you know, a good few options of swimming pools really close by. And so it's all, and then good coffee shops as well, which is always key. So, so that was kind of the initial link to New Zealand down here. There's actually quite a few triathletes that are based here. Andre Hewitt, who's sort of the top ITU New Zealand athlete, Dylan McNeese, Mike Phillips as well. So there's a few of us, but there's a great scene for riding and running and generally being outdoors.
Yeah, I was watching the Ironman New Zealand recast over the weekend while I was doing my long run. I want to get to that, but like it looks like just beautiful rolling countryside everywhere. And it seemed like there were a ton of New Zealand locals, like local pros that had actually showed up. So you must have a decent crew to ride with.
Yeah, it is. It is stunning down here. It really is beautiful. Here in Christchurch, we sort of have not so much rolling hills. We either got hills or flats, sort of not much in between, but it's still great. And yeah, I think the Kiwis appreciate what they have here in New Zealand and so enjoy being based at home, and to use the best of the terrain that they have right on their back garden and doorstep.
Where are you actually from?
I'm actually from the UK originally. So I was born in Nottinghamshire, which is pretty much in the middle of the UK, just Midlands north of England, and grew up there, and then I moved to Australia and spent 6 or 7 years in Australia from sort of end of 2007 through to early 2014, which was when I sort of and I, it was when I it was whilst in, whilst I was in Australia that I found or started doing triathlon. And then it grew from there. So yeah, my accent tends to have a little bit of a,
it was confusing off the top. That's why I had to ask. Usually I can pick out an Aussie or someone from Britain or what have you. And I was a little lost. So thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah. My family take great delight in taking the piss out of me because I go up at the end of my sentences like most Australians and Kiwis and Southern Hemisphere people do. And then obviously the people down here in Australia and New Zealand can tell I have sort of that English element to me. And then I think it just confuses most people in the rest of the world as to where I'm from.
And then you threw in a little bit of left-wing liberal accent from San Francisco for a few years, didn't you?
I did. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Just to so smooth them all out, confuse everyone.
Yeah, that's right. Based there for about 2 years on and off when I first turned pro. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into that, talk about how you actually got into triathlon, because I heard about that. It's a really, really interesting story how you went from like a background of all different sports to getting into triathlon through like a charity ride, a work ride, something like that.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I was lucky. I always played sport as a kid and growing up and loved sport. A lot of team sports, so netball and hockey, which is what we were the big sports, I guess. For
can I pause and ask what netball is? Because I saw this a couple times on your website. Like, I was so confused.
Yeah, so I guess the easiest way to explain it, it's most similar to basketball. The court's probably a little bit bigger, and you have two nets at either end of the court, like the basketball, but there's no backboard. So it's just a post with a ring on the top. There's seven players a team, and you are restricted to certain areas of the court that you can go into. So it's very much, it's a pretty fast game at the top level, and it's more about moving the ball around to score the goals. And it's, yeah, predominantly played in Commonwealth countries.
I'm into it. I was a air quotes professional curler, so I have a lot of appreciation for obscure sports that not too many people know about. Yeah, but anyway, yeah. Talk about how you got into tri.
Yeah. So, I guess growing up as well, I did a lot of track running, athletics. So, 300s as a junior and 300 meter hurdles, but then the 400 hurdles and on to 800s. But it was when I moved to Australia, and I think I was looking for just something new to do, or I tried to do my athletics again, but couldn't sort of find a group that I gelled with. You know, when you move to a new city like Sydney and you actually want to be exploring and seeing what the city has to offer. So It was with friends from work. We're doing a charity bike ride, which was by pure coincidence and no connection. It was the 90 kilometers, so the 56 miles. And it was A to B, sort of from Sydney down to Wollongong, along the coastline, which is beautiful. And then you jumped on the train back. And friends from work were doing it. So they said, oh, you know, you should come along and join us. And so thought it sounded quite good fun, and I think I bought a bike pretty much the week before, and it was a hybrid road mountain bike, so sort of the flat bar across the front, no clip-in pedals, so just normal pedals with my trainers. I can't even remember what kit I wore. I definitely wasn't, I don't think, anything cycling lycra related. It was probably just shorts and t-shirt. But just really enjoyed it. It was really good fun. It was a great ride. And so I wouldn't say I suddenly was an amazing cyclist, but I just found the riding was good fun and had, I don't know, an affinity or something to it. And I guess off the back of that, one of my friends from work sort of suggested I should give triathlon a go. And it's so big in Australia, and, you know, everybody does it, and school kids start doing triathlon from a really early age. So there's a great environment for starting the sport as a beginner.
Was there something about that ride that your friend ended up seeing in you that was like, oh, you got some potential here? Like, obviously the leap from you went for a bike ride to, hey, let's do a triathlon. That's a big leap. did you go and like crank it out on that hybrid bike?
I'm not sure I completely cranked it out. I definitely wasn't at the front of the race, but I think I probably put myself in the mix with people who looked pretty serious cyclists. And there was me in my trainers and t-shirt and shorts kind of thing on a hybrid. So it was probably maybe something to do with that. But I think just, you know, she knew I was sporty. We'd done some running training together for another running event in Sydney. And so she knew that I was looking for something, I guess. And yeah, and just suggested that triathlon, with it being so big in Australia, could be a good thing to try.
And how'd those first couple of races go when you finally did do a try? Did you do those first couple of races on the hybrid bike?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, my first race was on that hybrid. So my transition from bike to run was pretty quick, because I just sort of hopped off the bike and ran without having to change shoes, because I was already in my trainers. I did vouch, I think, while I was on that, in that race and on my bike, that I would invest in a proper triathlon bike, which at that point to me was a road bike with clip on aero bars. But then, you know, you get sucked in and then you buy the TT bike and everything like that. So it did progress pretty quickly. But yep, the first race was on the hybrid. And I remember enjoying it. I can't remember where I came in the race. Definitely wasn't winning my age group or anything like that, or even, I don't think, on the podium. But it was just something new. It was a new sport. I could see it was something I could develop at, as well as being able to train in Australia, where it's so good to be outside and it's hugely active. It was a great way to combine all those things and give it a bit of a go.
So at that time, you were working as a mechanical engineer, I understand. You know, how did you go from, again, this race or this bike race to ultimately turning pro and giving up your career?
So that's right. I was working. So I'd been posted out to Australia with my job as a mechanical engineer with Shell, just on a 2-year assignment. And at the end of the 2 years, Shell sort of tried to return me to the UK. And I said, oh, I'm having too much fun in Australia and enjoying lifestyle here. So thanks, but no thanks. I guess just starting, you know, always having that athletic or sporting background, and this was a new sport, and you can suddenly see with a bit of training and consistency, you can get sort of some big gains pretty quickly at the start when you're sort of starting from complete scratch. And, you know, I had a really good group that I joined over there, a group called Bondi Fit in Sydney, and it was really social as well. And so it was fun to turn up to training, because there'd always be a mix of people there and really good sessions on pretty much any day of the week. There would be several options for training. And I guess I'm a bit of an all or nothing. So I kind of threw myself into this, the training and things, and just developed and progressed from there, and started entering obviously more and more races, and got the chance to go to ITU World Champs. So for the sprint distance to start with, representing Great Britain. It was on the Gold Coast in 2009. I think I managed to get lucky with getting a slot, because I was already in Australia and not people from the UK were making the trip over. So I think they'd sort of said, oh, here you go, if you can get yourself to the Gold Coast, go and race. Just over those years of being in Australia, the hobby, as it started then, just grew and grew. And I guess I changed jobs a few times at that point, but more and more of my headspace was getting more sucked into my triathlon and the triathlon training and things like that. And I just got to a point of going, well, I'm not getting any younger. I've always done sport, but never, when I was growing up and going through school and university, sport was still very much seen by society as the hobby and not as a career. And so I'd always, you know, just had it as the hobby, and the focus was always on, you know, the academic side of life and going down that career conveyor belt. But I think being in Australia and like I said, not getting any younger and realizing that sport isn't around forever, yet the corporate world is. And with a few of my and the progression in the sport, I got to that stage of going, if I give this a shot now, then I never will, because it will be too late. I'll be too old. Because I didn't start the sport till I was 29. So pretty late on generally. And it was, yeah, one of those, you know, I don't want to look back in 10 or 20 years time and say, what if, and I never gave it a chance, you know, and I guess that combined with sort of not enjoying my job, probably because I was trying to do both corporate world and the triathlon to ability, and probably sort of falling, you know, perform well, but at that kind of mediocre level for where I wanted to be in either. So it was just sort of, yeah, it was one of those, we've got to give one of them a shot, and I'm not prepared to give the sport up. So let's,
That's a story that I think you kind of slough it off as, you know, it was a very clear decision, but I think that's a risky decision in a lot of people's mind that are maybe thinking about leaving a job for whatever dream it is that they've got. And I say, like, from the outside, comparing you to, say, the young people, like the ITU development people that are just shuffled along through under 21, under 23, ITU, it's not like they really even have a choice. They either move up or move out. In your case, like that is a big risky decision to pursue your dream and put career life on hold for a lot of people. What do you think it was that makes you different, that made it so clear to you that pursuing that dream was going to be the obvious choice?
It certainly wasn't an easy decision. You know, I know my parents were pretty wary at the time. I mean, I remember my dad actually, when I first left Shell but stayed in Australia, he was sort of quite concerned because, you know, Shell being a huge multinational company, and I think his words were, but they have a good pension scheme, was probably the factor. And so by the time I then came to sort of giving up the corporate world altogether, it might have softened the blow for them, but I think they were pretty concerned. And was there a particular trigger? Was it a definite decision? No, I mean, I had been thinking about it for a few months. The company I was working for at the time, and I had a fantastic boss, and they let me go down to 3 days a week for a while to see if that was an option, and that worked while I was still in Sydney. But I guess the other thing as well, you know, I probably actually didn't think about it too much in too much detail in terms of doing a financial analysis on what it meant to then turn professional and how I'd actually support myself. Because if I had done a proper analysis of what sort of money and stuff I would need, I'd have probably talked myself out of the decision, and I'd still be working at a desk in the corporate world, probably not very happy. And so it was a little bit of a kind of flippant decision when it came to it, because it was, okay, you can't procrastinate any longer because you are getting older. It is that now or never situation, and don't think too much about the finite details of where your next money is going to come from. Let's just, you know, take a leap and a jump and see how long it lasts for and see what we can work out. And yeah, I guess sort of the blind faith that if it didn't happen, I could effectively return to the corporate world, or I'd go back to mum and dad's and stay there for a while, I guess, if things all went completely tits up. But yeah, and the first couple of years, definitely, well, even now, you know, it's definitely not easy. You go from having that security and safety of the corporate salary coming into your bank account every month, regardless of whether effectively you perform or you don't perform, to then, as a complete sort of beginner still really in the sport, and again moving across to the States, of going, okay, how do we make this work? There's no job description. There's nobody that's going to suddenly go, oh, you've got PRO, pro behind your name. Yeah, of course we're going to give you some money. You know, that it doesn't work like that. You've got to be very self-sufficient and pretty tough-skinned, I guess, to survive those first few years to try and make that step up to actually making it into a, you know, a profession that you are earning. I mean, the flip side of it, I didn't do it, or I don't do it for the money. You know, if I was wanting the money and the salary and stuff, I'd probably still be in the court, you know, well, of course I'd still be in the corporate world. It was a decision to go, I've done sport all my life and I've always shied away from taking that next step. And so this was an opportunity to do that and to just see what would happen and give myself the chance.
Well, and that was kind of a question that popped up for me. A lot of people who become pro had always dreamed from a young age of becoming a pro athlete of some type, and for some even a pro triathlete. Did you have dreams as a younger person of being a professional athlete of some type, or was this really truly like a 180 for you?
Look, as a kid, I loved sport. And I remember, you know, Barcelona Olympics was probably the first sort of real sporting impact that it had on my life. As a kid, I wanted to be that Olympic athlete. I wanted to go to the Olympics, but I don't think I really ever believed it was possible in what I was doing or in the UK at that time. You know, sport was still very much the hobby and things that, you know, it wasn't given that serious focus. I didn't have a clue about triathlon either at that point. In the UK, it was all probably going to be the netball or the athletics route that I'd have gone down. But I just don't think I believed that it was an option. Everything was always geared towards, you know, you get your academic qualifications and you go to university and you get a job and, yeah, you might do some sport and that's great and it's good to be fit and healthy and active and it might be a bit of a serious hobby, but it was never... I never saw it or it was never shown to me as a viable career. And I think that was probably one of the things from being in Australia, which just has this huge sporting culture. And I do say, I think that Great Britain and England and the UK is very different now. And that's thanks to the lottery funding and obviously the Olympics in 2012 did a massive amount to elevate sport and wider sport. But I think for me, when I grew up, there wasn't that in place as much. But in Australia, sport was much bigger part of life there. And, you know, I remember even, you know, when I was an age grouper, and probably about a year before I turned professional, people were saying to me, you know, oh, you could go pro. Are you going to turn pro? And I was kind of just sort of half laughing and looking at them going, gosh, I've only started this sport a couple of years ago. I'm winning and racing Olympic distance races as, you know, and there's not really an option of going professional at that level because you have to go down the ITU route and, you know, I was too old for that and not quick enough either. But at an age group level, I was doing okay. So there was a lot more appreciation or a lot more awareness in Australia of sport as a career, which I don't think you had in the UK.
I could see that. Yeah, I could see that. And in Canada here, it's kind of like, if you want to do sport besides hockey, like hockey is almost like religion here, but other sports, if you want to do it, there's not a ton of funding. Like a friend of mine is, for the next couple months, at least, he's still the reigning Olympic gold medal curler. And he funded his way basically almost out of his pocket and with scratching and clawing for sponsors here and there where he could possibly find it, and maybe broke even for 15, 20 years before it actually became something that he could call his career, because it just wasn't one of those A-level sports. And here in Canada, it's like you get a job, go down the corporate world, and that's what you do. I asked this of Sarah Crowley, and it sounds like you guys had a fairly similar path going down the corporate world, her in corporate finance, you with mechanical engineering. Do you still make spreadsheets about anything in triathlon with your old engineering skills?
I do like lists and I do make spreadsheets, but probably not, I don't think, to the extent that Sarah does with her financial background. Mine are fairly a little bit more basic in general, but I do have like my Excel spreadsheets of races and then tracking the finance side of things, and a few things like that. But I'm a list person as well. I do kind of like my lists and logical thinking, so there's still a little bit of an engineer inside.
Yeah, you'd be more like calculating the wind velocity coming back from Javi, where
whereas
Sarah would
level.
Be like, what's the valuation of this race?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
One thing, this story I read, maybe just one little blip on your website, that before we get into, say, last year, I want to make sure that we don't skip over this because I am so intrigued. I'm on the edge of my seat here. Can you explain how your butterfly stroke got your school team disqualified twice?
I can't. I have no idea. I mean, again, did all sorts of sports at school, and we didn't have it's the UK, so it's not that we had a huge swimming program at schools. It was just one of those, you might do a few swimming lessons as part of the sports, the PE program, but it definitely wasn't sort of the squad setup that there is in the States. But I guess because I was sporty and my parents had been great and they'd given me lessons as a kid, so I'd learned to swim. I could swim. And I guess because of that, I was always put in the butterfly for the relay. I still to this day have no idea why I got disqualified. I think I might have been doing like breaststroke kick rather than the butterfly kick. So my arms were doing butterfly, but I think my legs were probably doing breaststroke. And I think that was possibly the reason why I got the team disqualified.
Play ignorant. I see where you're going with this. Good call.
Yeah.
Good call. Be like, no, perfect technique. I don't know what you're talking about, Judge.
Yeah.
let's talk about Ironman New Zealand this past year. You mentioned it and we talked about it just briefly there. So I watched it on Sunday.
Yes.
And you had a really good race there. Before we get into my exact question about it, that there was a moment in the race that I found really fascinating. Do you want to just give kind of the quick Cole's notes of how that race went for you?
Ironman New Zealand, the last 2 years I've done it after Challenge Wanaka, which is a full distance as well. So they're 2 weeks apart. So you kind of go into Ironman New Zealand not really sure what will happen and if the body's going to show up or not. But it was one of those days where the weather just we'd had an absolutely perfect weather day in Wanaka, which is in the South Island of New Zealand. So that was 2 weeks before. And then Taupo I can remember waking up through the night before the race, just hearing the wind howling. So it meant that when we got down to the race start, the lake was pretty chopped up, which was actually probably better for me. So I had a decent average swim. And came out with a couple of other women, which was put me in a pretty good place, and got onto the bike, and it's a two lap out and back course, usual kind of New Zealand rough surface roads or slow roads, and it was again pretty windy on those sections on the bike, but felt pretty good considering Wanaka the 2 weeks earlier, and sort of I guess grew into the race. And but I was riding with, I think it was Yvonne Van Vlerken and Jocelyn McCauley at that point. And so between the three of us, by the end of, I think it was probably about 10K to go, we managed to catch Meredith Kessler and Annabelle Luxford, who were at the front of the race. And I just made sure I wanted to get into transition first. But it meant that there were sort of five of us coming into transition all at the same time, which was pretty exciting. And then it would sort of come down to a foot race, so to speak, over the marathon. So I headed out onto the run in first, which was absolutely fantastic, but very quickly went to fifth as the other women went past me, and just was in that space of, you know, just stick to your own race at this point and hopefully just keep going and ease into it. And probably realistically thought that fifth would be where I'd finish, because then the other women were all at that point better runners really than me. And I hadn't resigned myself to just sticking in fifth, but just probably was like, well, you know, it's a pretty good finish after Wanaka, and I knew we had a bigger gap to the women behind us, and pretty happy with the caliber of women that were in that top five positions. But just as the run went on, and I seemed to sort of get stronger and stronger, and suddenly everyone started coming back to me and started re-overtaking Yvonne and then Annabelle and then Meredith, and suddenly found myself in second. And Jocelyn was sort of a little bit too far ahead to catch, and she was running ridiculously well, as she does. So yeah, super happy then to sort of come down the finish line and take second.
Yeah, that's a fantastic race. It was cool to watch. And the moment that I'm really curious about that you mentioned in that rebroadcast was when you passed Meredith, you could see that she was struggling, and you said something along the lines of you saw that she was struggling and you wanted to help her get to the finish line, or you wanted to help her pick her spirits up. And that was really, really, like, I don't know, it was counterintuitive to how I thought racing would be, because you two are like, your livelihoods depend on being second over third or on the podium versus fourth. And here you are passing probably the biggest competitor on the day and saying that you want to help her.
Yeah. You know, Meredith and I, you know, you're friends as well with these women. And yes, when you're racing, you're there to beat them and you're there to win. But, you know, if I know how much that race means to Meredith. I could see she wasn't having her usual run that she wanted. And it was just to try and, you know, as I went past, it was to try and just offer a few words of encouragement of saying, you know, just run, come on, just run with me for a bit or something like that. Probably hoping in my head that yes, she wouldn't, or she would try to, and then thinking, have I kicked myself? Am I now going to have like a sprint finish for the last 7K? And that sort of thing. It's not fun seeing competitors struggle and stuff as much as, yes, you are there to beat them, but you still want everyone to have their best day. And so I think it was just a few words along those lines of come with me or keep going or something like that. But ultimately, I mean, I didn't dare change what I was doing at that point. I think we still had sort of 8 or 9K to go. So you're still not sure what the body's going to do over those last few kilometers. And if the legs might suddenly say, oh yeah, that's enough. And whether you're going to be ending up struggling a few more kilometers down the line. You go through all sorts of emotions and highs and lows and ups and downs. And I think whilst you are there to win or to beat the other women, there's a huge camaraderie, I get, between most people, of the training and the hard work that goes into it and the ups and downs that happen on the day.
So you're able to sort of put that ahead of your need, because it is a need to actually place as well as you can for, like Taryn had said in his question, for your financial well-being. You're able to kind of put your own interests aside for a minute because someone you care about ostensibly was having trouble.
Yes, there is a financial need, and obviously higher up it is obviously the better, and the results and the subsequent off spin off that is obviously better the higher you up. And you know, I don't think I would have, I was doing it to drag her along. I came third kind of thing. I just wanted to help her get to the finish, and I'd have still been fighting to stay ahead. But also I think when you're racing, if you get too caught up in thinking about that outcome at the end and that pressure of I have to get first or second, or I need these points, or I need this money, or et cetera, et cetera, it completely distracts and takes away from what you're doing at that moment, at that time in the race. I mean, if you're doing everything at that point and moment in time to get the very most out of your body and be moving forward as fast as you can at that point, then I can't have any control over what the other women are doing. And so if I have my very best race, but it still puts me in fifth or eighth, and hence, you know, not as much money or points or whatever come out of that, but I've still done the best I could on the day. And I think if you lose track of that process and being in that moment at that point and racing and controlling that now situation, and again, like I said, if you're if you're doing everything at that moment in your capability to be swimming, riding, running, whatever it is, to the very best of your ability and moving forward at the fastest progress you can make with what your body's giving you, then that's all you can kind of do. And the results and what that means will then just, it'll be what it'll be and it'll happen.
It's kind of, it sounds similar to something that Mark Allen was saying to us a few months ago, that if you can get negative thoughts out of your brain, and specifically he was talking about like the chatter that goes on in your head throughout a race, but I imagine that just negative thoughts of pressure of placing well, pressure of beating a competitor, like just those bad vibes, that negative emotion is actually more draining than anything. So if you can just focus on the process, and by focusing on the process, put yourself in a position where you can have the mindset to help a competitor along, that's more good vibes, man.
It is all about, you know, how best you deal with those negative and dark spaces to keep yourself going and to give yourself the best outcome. I think you do the, you know, whilst yes, we're here to earn a living and it's our job, you are doing it because you love the sport and you're passionate about it and what that sport means. And if you get, you know, I guess when I first, in my first year as a professional, I think when I was racing, I did put a lot of pressure on myself because I felt I had to prove to myself and to others that I'd done the right thing in making this decision to leave the corporate world and be a professional. And there was this pressure to, well, where is my next money coming from? How am I going to live, sort of thing? And I need to place at this race, or I need to get this result. I started getting too stressed about that side of racing and that side of the sport, and that process of doing my training, being present in my training, being consistent with my training, and having the faith that, well, not having the confidence that the results would then happen.
I like it. Mm-hmm. I like it. I mean, yeah. I'm into it. It's a good,
well,
good
really,
vibes.
I mean, I think other people we've interviewed as well have sort of expressed that same sentiment that, you know, there's only so long that you're going to get a chance to do this in life. These things do have a shelf life, and you may as well try to enjoy the process every single day, because there's going to be a day you're going to look back and say, man, I miss that. I wish I could be doing that now. You know, so you got to enjoy it while you got it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's incredibly privileged that I get to do this every day as a living, as a career, I guess. You know, I still get people asking me, how long's your career break for? And when are you going to go back to the corporate world? And how long are you going to do this for? And it's like, well, at the moment I see it, it's my career, and I'll do it as long, I'm not putting a timeline on it, because I want to, as long as I still see myself improving and I can do it sustainably and I can still be competitive and that sort of thing, and I'm enjoying it, then why can't I keep doing it as long as I could? But yeah, ultimately there will be a time when I have to do something different, because your body can't keep up with you. And so it is about making the most of it every day. And I mean, that's probably why I do, probably why I am so global. You know, I want to make the most of the opportunities I've got to be doing cool races in different places all over the world, so that I look back over my career in triathlon and go, yeah, that was effing good kind of thing. I loved that. And I got to see some amazing countries and meet some fantastic people. And at the same time, I pushed myself and learned a lot about myself and was competitive and could compete against and be one of the best in the world.
I don't know if you picked up on that, Kim, but that effing, that, I think that's a cross between Australia, liking to rip it up a little bit with the expletives, mm-hmm. but still being British
and proper. Yes. I caught it.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this, Laura. I like it.
I gave you no warning to do, like, I didn't know whether you had to bleep it out or anything, or if it was that.
Well,
it
just, we can say whatever we want.
Yeah, I'll, no. Yeah, Kim has heard everything that I say. It's bad.
The rest of the world, though, you know, yeah. Got to put that expletive warning.
Rest of the year, you had a really good year. And one thing that really stood out to me was you did a ton more challenge races than Ironman. Why challenge over Ironman?
Because it's a fantastic brand and there is more to triathlon than the Ironman brand. There are other events and other races out there. I guess from Challenge Wanaka was probably one of the first races I did, and I just absolutely loved it, and got the opportunity to meet some of the Challenge family team, and got invited to Challenge Rote that year. So that was, I think, 2 years ago initially. And went there, and again, that's an absolutely incredible race. And just, I really like what the brand are trying to do. I just find it a lot more welcoming and friendly and supportive to a pro at any level, regardless of ranking and rating and how good you are. They really make you feel valued. And I guess last year, I just got the opportunity. I wanted to go back and do Challenge Rote again. And so there's an opportunity to work with Challenge and be a little bit of an ambassador for them for their European series. One thing that Challenge family do in Europe, which is fantastic, they run a series over their European races. So where you accumulate points, you can have up to six races, and two of those can be full distance races. And you collect points over the year. And then at the end of the year, they pay out a bonus to the top five in that ranking. And it's a sizable bonus. It's, you know, in a sport that doesn't pay huge amounts, when you've got the opportunity to earn an extra 25,000 euros, then why not go for it? And so, yeah, so that's why I headed to Europe, and it fitted in to do the Challenge races. I guess, you know, Kona was a little bit of a goal last year, and I was lucky that I secured points for that early on in the year through Ironman New Zealand and Ironman Australia, and so I could go to Europe and race the Challenge series, and managed to finish second in the series, so got a bonus payout at the end as well, which was hugely grateful.
Yeah, and you were second in, like, it's not like this is a B level tour here. Yvonne Van Vlerken, she was first. You had Sophie Goose, Heather Wertel, Lucy Charles. Like, you killed it.
Yeah.
And we had interviewed the Wertels a while back.
Yeah, Heather and Trevor were chasing those top five spots.
Right. And so it's kind of interesting to talk to somebody else who's made that choice to really immerse themselves in the other brand of triathlon, of Ironman distance races. And, you know, I love the sound of that when you're talking about it being so welcoming and all of that. I mean, obviously the Ironman brand itself, there's a reason it's so popular. There's a lot of excitement around it. It's big, it's huge, it's professional, but there is something to be said for a brand that makes you feel not just like a number, right? And that does kind of bring you in no matter what level you're at, like you said, and you just feel like, yeah, this is the place for me. I think that's really neat to hear.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, they're obviously stronger in Europe, and they've got some races in Asia and Asia Pacific. They just put on different races. They're in, you know, it's not necessarily about getting a fast PR time on a flat, boring ass course. You know, they do things different. Like one of the races in the Challenge series was in Rome, right in the center of Rome, and you're cycling past the Colosseum. And it's a different distance race. It's not your standard half iron distance race, because they based it on the number 753, which is a year, hopefully I've got that right, Rome was founded. So, you know, the swim was 1.753 kilometers, and the bike was, 735, I think, 73.5 or 75.3. And then my history teacher is going to be appalled. And then, and then the run was 17.53 kilometers. And so, you know, and it was great. And it was really cool to be able to race in pretty much, you know, past the Colosseum and be in Rome and all those things. And then they've just got some beautiful races. Challenge Volsi in Austria is stunning. And, you know, Challenge Herning in Denmark, you're running through a library and you're running up and down, you know, up and down sort of spiral walkways over pedestrian bridges. And it just makes it different and interesting and fun. And it's not all about that fast, flat, I have to get a PR and I have to get to Kona.
Right. And I mean, yeah, they may be different distances and they may not be exactly the same as the official Ironman distances, but you're still challenging your body. It's still incredibly hard. It's still, you know, you still have to be just as trained, just as fine tuned of an athlete to complete these distances. And you happen to have that just a totally different environment. So it's neat to me. I love the flexibility of that. It doesn't take away from the accomplishment of the race that you've done. You also just get some super cool life experiences as part of it, which I think is just really awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's still swim, bike, run.
Yep.
It's still got those three elements. And I just think, I think some of the times it's more, you get a bigger sense of achievement because some of the courses are so, and it's not the pun intended, but so challenging, you know, with the hills or the technical descents or that sort of thing, or the locations that they're in. And they're just beautiful. And so, look, I think Ironman is a fantastic brand, and I think they've done an amazing job at creating the mystique, the mystery, and the pull that everyone has to get to Kona and to do the world championships. But the sport does need other brands, and it does need challenge to be able to compete and put on different series of races for all different reasons.
What are the implications of making that decision to race more challenge races as opposed to Ironman, though? Because you hear of a lot of pros that almost feel like they're on a hamster wheel of having to race because of sponsorship commitments or chasing Kona Pro ranking points. Or, I mean, I suppose that's going to change this year with new qualification standards. But is there is this a big decision when you're planning out a year?
Yeah, it can be. You know, I think if we touch briefly on the new Kona qualification system, you know, it's interesting. I'm undecided on the reason behind it and the pros and cons and the benefits and whatnot.
I can't decide if it's going to be easier or harder to qualify.
Well, that's an offline conversation. My thoughts at the moment, I think. But I think what it will do is it will open the door to athletes having more option to race the challenge series of races and to race other brands and do other races rather than just being sucked in and tied into chasing points and stuff. It is still the industry as a whole is still geared more towards Ironman as a brand, and to the extent of the brainwashing, it's really hard to convince sponsors that other races exist which are just as reputable and can give you just as much exposure, and so sometimes you have to fight pretty hard for that, because even the industry sponsors are so tied into the Ironman brand of racing that it can make it quite difficult to encourage them to look wider and to have a bigger perspective on the triathlon as a sport.
Sure. And I think that's like with anything, right? You get sort of the big player in the game and people think the biggest is the best and the only, whereas there's other totally viable options out there that in actuality, for some people, may be a better option. The biggest isn't always the best, doesn't have to be the best, doesn't have to be the only, right?
Interesting and kind of similar that I questioned somebody from the industry over the past month or so that, like, we're trying to make a go of making a living in triathlon, creating a media business in triathlon, but it's a different media business. We're not a magazine. We're not a traditional publication or a website with tons of clicks and articles and things like that. So we don't smell like a media publication. And I asked somebody flat out from the industry, I was like, you know, why is it like, you know, we're trying to teach a donkey how to sit when I talk to potential sponsors of our family of podcasts and videos and things like that. And the person said, you know what? It's a very slow moving industry that they're set in their ways, and they go to the standards. They go to Ironman. They go to the top 20 pros that are racing Ironman. And outside of that, nobody's really willing to look at alternatives. I think a lot of the same things you're seeing, we're seeing on
the other side of it.
Just on a little bit different side of it.
Yeah, it's true. Very true.
Yeah. After kind of besmirching Iron Man's character, let's talk about Kona. you've written about it. I mean, if anyone wants to go and read the entire play-by-play of your race, you did a fantastic job of it on your blog. Clearly you're not pumped with your performance. I finished 15th. I think actually like very, very good, but obviously not exactly what you're hoping for. Saving you going through rehashing something that you've done dozens of times before, was there like just one specific aspect of that race that you think you could have improved upon that you're going to be taking into future years?
It was pretty much the start of the bike. I was at the time I was pretty happy with my swim and where it brought me out of the water with a group of good women.
Where were you? About 7 minutes back, I want to say.
Yeah, I'm not sure on exact time, but I was kind of with Heather Jackson and Carrie Lester, I think, was there, and Susie Cheatham. And so we're sort of pretty happy with where that had put me. I mean, in hindsight, going back, I think probably a few of us in that pack felt we should have been a couple of minutes quicker, but that's what happens. That's racing kind of thing. And hindsight's awesome for that. But I think it was once I got on the bike and we'd ridden the first loop around town and I knew how to ride it. We talked all about before the race of doing my race and et cetera, et cetera. But there was an opportunity in that first section on the bike. Kaiser Sali, she was another one that was with us, and her and Heather kind of rode past me, and at that point I should have that was my ticket, I guess, if you say that was my, they were the girls I should have been riding with on that bike course, particularly Heather, and I think I didn't take that opportunity. I think looking back on the race, I let the race quash me rather than raise me, I guess. Leading into the race as well, I'd spoken to my coach about, it's just another race. Done loads of them all year and it's no different from that. And I think whilst I understand that and it is just another race, ultimately though, it is very different. It is Kona, it is the World Championships, and there's a lot of hype that goes along with that. And I think I found that I kind of tracked myself between trying to play the race down and trying to quash all the excitement and the nerves and be very relaxed about it, but then not using the race to pump myself up to be in that race mode and mentality. So I kind of think I got kind of stuck in this no man's land of approaching the race and what that then actually materialized on the day, if that makes any kind of sense.
Well, you did mention that leading into the race, you thought that you might have done too many sponsor commitments or too many appearances in the 2 weeks prior to the race or so. What does your schedule look like leading up to the race as a pro?
So it's an interesting one as well, because I think for me, it's my first time in Kona. I'm very grateful for the sponsors I have, but I don't have huge sponsors. And I'm still trying to very much make that step. And I want to support and help and do the right thing by everybody. And I'd been warned about overcommitting and that sort of thing. And I felt I'd planned things, again, being a planner and logistic and having my lists and things and my spreadsheets. I thought I'd planned things pretty well. I tried to front. I was there in Kona 2 weeks before the race, and I tried to sort of front load the first week with more of the commitments and the catch-ups and the meetings with sponsors and with people, so that it would leave me that second week a little bit freer. And it probably doesn't totally work out with that, because a few things do spill over, and then just the adrenaline, the hype, tends to reach another level in that last week anyway. And just getting around and people. So, I tended to have things most days that I was doing, whether it was just sort of meet and greets with sponsors or trying to get around to see people or a few videos. I mean, I felt I was pretty good in a lot of the content that I that was produced or released whilst in Kona. I mean, some of that I'd done months before and written and that sort of thing. So it probably looked like I was doing more. But I think probably, and it kills me to say this because I feel I'm pretty good at being in that prepared and planned state, but just hadn't appreciated how much it would take out of me and then put me in this whole like trying to put it into just another race and play it down, but obviously using those opportunities because I feed off those as well. Like, I love that engagement and that buzz of meeting people and having those interactions, so I kind of have to use that sometimes to get myself in the right place for a race. But yeah, probably just didn't realize quite how different Kona is on that respect. You know, I've been to Kona the few years before to watch the race and, you know, even as a pro, but you go to watch and that's, you know, and it's great and you feel like you've experienced that buzz and that hype. But I found it was a very different situation this time when your name's suddenly on the start list and suddenly there's a bit more interest around you being there. You know, whereas I'd have been quite happy to do all the commitments and stuff when I was there as a pro but not racing, because you've got the time. And then yeah, it's a tricky one. How do you balance those commitments in terms of, yes, you're there to race, but also you have to be seen to do the right thing by sponsors and things, you know. And interestingly, you know, some people like Sarah and a few others said to me afterwards, they said, you just have to say no and you have to shut yourself away. Maybe I will be able to do that in years to come as I'm a bit more established, but as I still feel I am a professional that is trying to make those relationships and break into that really world class, you want to be seen. You don't want to be saying no, because that might, you know, that's might turn around next year and say, well, we're not going to support you or things like that. So it's, I guess, there's that kind of balance as well.
Makes sense. Yeah. When we were there covering, we saw that from the other side of it. We got in Sunday night. We would have been trying to get interviews with, I won't say specifically who, but it would have been one of the favorite male pros. And their agent said to us flat out, no, past Tuesday morning, yeah, we don't do anything.
Yeah.
Just flat out, it's done. But this is somebody who probably has lifelong sponsors because they've been in it for so long and at the top of their game for so long. And I was on the other end of it, treating it as my coming out party, that we were there to be as busy as possible and say yes to absolutely everything, because
we weren't racing it though.
we weren't racing. Yeah. So in your case, yeah, it's a dicey beast. Going back to Kona this year, ideally, or focusing on challenge?
A little undecided. I mean, I'm really mixed. I do feel I have unfinished business at Kona. So I think I would like to go back and just get again that performance that I feel is more reflective of where I'm at, and I can kind of feel proud of. Obviously, it depends on qualifying, and I will go back to Europe and race challenge again. So at the moment, my thinking is, you know, if I am fortunate enough to get points through the Ironman races I do for the coming months, then yes, and that puts me in the right position to qualify, then yes, I'll go back to race in Kona and hopefully have that performance that I can be pretty happy with. If I'm borderline or if I haven't got the points come middle of the year, end of the year, I don't know, have to make some decisions whether it would be worth it for me. Yeah. And again, things that play into that from a financial, from a sponsor point of view, to add in a few more Ironman branded races to get more points to get there, or whether I look at other options and do different races for the year and then build towards the qualifying for the following year.
Couple interesting things. Sarah Crowley was 15th 2 years ago and then ends up on the podium this year.
It's true.
Just saying.
She was saying.
but I guess that new qualification standard ends up putting you in a tricky spot, because if you end up having to try to qualify late, you've got to basically win to get in. So you have to turn a race that's close to Kona into an A race, and all of a sudden then you're getting to Kona, and you've already done your A race potentially. So that, that's sticky.
I guess I'm not quite sure how the slot allocation is going to work fully yet. With there's a lot of changes with who signs up for races and who's on the start list. So how are you going to allocate slots? And then obviously as the year goes on, if people become injured or decide they're not going to race, how do you reallocate or have, cause at the moment there's kind of the roll down, that probably can't really exist because it's all going to be on an individual race basis. And like you said, yeah, it might needs a bit of thinking on how you then plan out your year. And if you go for, try and do, yeah, the early qualification with slots and stuff. We'll see. It's going to be interesting. I think it'll be good to sort of get back racing this year and be able to sort of talk a little bit more to the other pros and get their thoughts on it and what it potentially means in terms of the races and the qualification and that sort of thing. So yeah, it'd be definitely interesting space to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to start working towards wrapping up, being respectful of your time here. Before we go, I saw some very fun things on your website that I'd like some rapid fire answers from you here.
Okay. Don't worry.
Didn't warn you about this, but they're tough.
No, I might play the whole, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you there. You cut out.
Yeah, no, sorry. I don't understand. I only speak British. Yeah. okay. You say that food is your weakness. What are your top three go-to indulgences after a big workout day?
After a workout. So when I'm trying to be pretty good, I love avocado, poached eggs and that sort of thing, but I'm a chocoholic at heart, I guess. So, that would be my guilty pleasure. I have to really avoid buying it so that I'm one of these people, if I've got chocolate in the house, once that bar's open, it doesn't get saved. It'll all go. I can't have like one square and leave the rest of it in the fridge.
Well, and you guys have that good Cadbury chocolate in the UK, and that's the premium stuff.
Oh, definitely. It has to be British Cadbury's chocolate. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yep. Yeah. The best ones are the giant Dairy Milk buttons.
Yeah.
I always, whenever I leave the UK, I buy however many bags worth I can at the airport and bring them back.
Well, just a hot tip. There's a Walmart here in Winnipeg that actually sells those Cadbury buttons. A Walmart, if you can believe it.
Oh my God,
yes.
That's amazing.
Yes, I know. Crazy. Anyway, continue,
Taryn.
So you've
got a hookup. Next one. You said that if you chose to have a superpower, it would be to be invisible. What would you do with said superpower? And would you use it for good or evil?
I'd definitely use it for good, I think.
That's lame. I wasn't looking for that question. I wanted rob a bank, something
Although,
like that.
Having said that, it would be quite good to put the invisible cloak on and then just go and like be, you know, like a fly on the wall
lurk
in people's conversations.
Lurk around.
See what they're doing and maybe play a few tricks on people of moving things around.
Going to Andrew Messick's office and mess around with his computer so that every time he tries to type an I, it's an M or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Next question. There's a picture with you on the ground and a dog is on top of you. Who is that dog?
That is Bondi Buster. So he's my coach, or my first coach when I was in Sydney, Spot Anderson. It's his dog, Buster. And I was back there visiting a few days I'd moved to the States by that stage. And the Buster decided to sort of attack me when I was sitting on the ground and pin me down, bless him.
Oh, you look
cutie pie.
You looked very willing in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
that was it. Kim, do you think she won?
I think she won.
She probably won. Yeah.
What do I win? Chocolate buttons?
Yes.
Yeah. We've got a hookup.
Next time I see you, I'll bring you some chocolate buttons.
Yeah, just
awesome.
Down the road.
Fantastic.
That's it. Let's give a shout out to any sponsors or direct listeners to where they can find you online here, Laura.
Yeah. So find me online. My website, I think, is just laurasiddall.com. I'm on Twitter, at LM Siddall, and Instagram is at LM Sid. Often referred to as Sid is my nickname.
Reach two D's, out two L's, right?
Two D's and two L's, correct. Yes. Reach out on social media, but you know, if anyone's at any races and I'm there, make sure you come up and say hello. Love meeting people who are involved in the sport and that side of things. Shout outs, probably I should shout out to my coach, Matt Dixon, and Paul Buick and the Purple Patch squad. We head over to Arizona at the end of the week for a training camp. So it'll be good to get back with the whole squad and some time with Matt and Paul there.
As in like end of next week, you're going to be in Arizona?
Yeah, on Friday. Yeah, fly out on Friday.
Well, son of a bitch, I'm going to be there.
I'm going to have to go buy some buttons for you and give them to Taryn to take.
I'm going
to
have to import some buttons.
Ah, fantastic.
Yeah, I'm going to be there for the triathlon business conference.
Oh, cool.
Because I'm a big fancy business guy. I'm going to be like the black sheep. They're going to be talking about actual media things. And I'm like, I make Speedo videos.
Yeah.
You're going to be the disruptive one. It's good. We need disruption in the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
maybe not this kind of disruption.
Yeah, it's going to be my first time there. So I think I'm going to go up to like, you know, Mike Riley or Jerry Rodriguez who've been on the podcast before and say, you know what, guys, it's like my first day at school. Do you mind if I eat lunch with you?
Yeah.
Please be my friend.
Yeah. And sorry, I cut you off. Who are the sponsors that you're going to be sporting this year?
Yep. So still be riding SIPO bikes, which is great. So very happy to continue with them and Scody. So on Team Scody with like Sarah. So they're kid in apparel. And then I'll shout out Shots Nutrition, which is an Australian company, and have been incredibly supportive for me from being an amateur. And I'll also do a bit of a shout out to Hoka. So I'm joining Hoka on a team this year. So they've been fantastic. And also Cask Helmets. And that's probably they are.
That's a good looking lineup. I like what Scody's doing. I've been chatting with them a little bit lately and learning more about their kits.
It's cool. I like they got some cool designs, but they're super great to work with. We're just at the moment sort of going back and forth with my race kit for this coming year, and their designers are great and really really great to work with and bounce ideas around and stuff like that, and are doing a great job at converting my horrific sketches into something that looks actually pretty good.
It's a nice lineup. Thank you very much, Laura. We'll link everything in the show notes, and maybe I'll drop off some chocolates to you in Arizona.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It was great to chat to you guys.
Thanks. Talk to you again, Laura. Thank you.
If there was anything on the podcast that you heard and you want to know more about, you can visit our show notes at triathlontaryn.com/topics/triathlontaryn podcast. We'll have all of the links listed there. Any other info that you may not have had time to write down or whatever, it's listed there for you in perpetuity.
Something newer, juicier, freer.
We love free.
We've had resources kind of scattered throughout the website for the past year that we've built up. Well, I have put that all on one single page on the website at triathlontaryn.com/free resources. Just by entering your email address, you can get a free swim drill program, a free strength training program, a running drill program. And as we start coming out with things, everything will be there. So you can check it now. You can check it later.
Come early, come often. Mm-hmm. We'll be adding stuff all the time, so make sure you check it out frequently. Also, if you've got questions for Taryn, and many of you do, and you leave them in the YouTube comments, Facebook, Instagram, etc., we're trying to aggregate that all into one spot so everybody can see and hear the answer. And that's why we've now launched the Triathlon Trainiask podcast, because it's Trainiacs asking questions. So what we want you to do is head over to triathlontaryn.com/trainiask. If you have a question, you'll record it and Taryn may answer it on the podcast. He's recording them every single weekday, and you can find the podcast on every single podcast player out there. And Trainiask is spelled TRAINIASK.
Short nuggets of info. Every episode, I guarantee under 10 minutes.
Perfect.
And it's hard to get me to stop talking. So this is a feat. Finally, last thing that you can do is if you like this show or the Trainiask show when you check it out, head over to iTunes, give us a review, good, bad, indifferent. Hopefully 5 stars because we're pretty awesome.
Reviews just really help us out.
It really helps with the iTunes algorithm. However it happens, it works. It's internet magic and helps other new or aspiring trainiacs discover us. So that would be much appreciated.
Thanks, folks. See you next time.